Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Well, hello everyone from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson, and you are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on this magical network we call Blog Talk Radio. We have a fantastic show planned tonight. Joining us in just a little bit from Idaho, Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum will be with us, author of the book Sasquatch Legend Meets Science. So we're looking forward to tonight's show. It should be a dandy as we enjoy very temperate weather here in the central part of Indiana, about 75 degrees. It's absolutely beautiful, and we're loving this weather quite a bit. And a big hello to all of our friends in Washington, D.C. We had a chance to see lots of youngsters, and of course, Benny Williams with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Department of Fisheries. He hosted once again a spectacular event on a reflecting pond next to the World War II Memorial as they stocked that pond with bass, bluegill, perch, and crappie, and youngsters from the inner city of Washington, D.C. had a chance to go fishing. It was a spectacular weekend, and we terrorized them with live reptiles. It was a pretty good time in Washington, D.C., and we'll have an update on that in the next couple of weeks with our good friend from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Benny Williams. As always, handling the technical responsibilities, our studio producer, Melissa Hovey, technical engineer, Wayne Larson, music controlled by Scott Carney, and from the massive Wild World News Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Well, good evening, Mr. Batson. Did I tell you how many tadpoles I ended up with?
Well, I knew that I took a bucket load over there to your house. How many were there after the final count?
Well, there were 111 total.
Wow.
So you were pretty close. You said there, oh, I think there's about 100 in there. We have, today we have about 50 frogs.
Oh.
Yes, and the others are waiting their chance to be released.
And for the folks that did not listen to past programs when we were talking about, these are wood frogs. And they're pretty cool. They've got little copper-colored spots on their bellies.
Quite beautiful.
Yeah, so we're excited about that. The following portion of Larry Batson's Wild World is brought to you by Alphabet Swamp, the children's book by Cheryl and Larry Batson. Order your copy today, autographed copy, by the way, today at www.larrytheanimalguy.com. That's our official website, or send check or money order for $10 per copy to WS 4140 North, 600 West, Greencastle, Indiana, 46135. Shipping and handling is included.
It's now time from his broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis, Indiana, the distinguished Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News.
Good evening. This is Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News for June 7th. Well, our first two stories tonight start out in Anchorage, Alaska. Now, if you don't like rats, you're going to like this story. Rat Island is no more.
Oh.
With the rats dead and gone from Rat Island, the Alaskan island has a new name.
Mm.
The U.S. Geological Survey Board on Geographic Names approved a new moniker for the remote uninhabited island after area residents lobbied for something that would better reflect their Aleut history and traditions. Now, the name is a little confusing. The island will now be known as Hawadax, which originates from a word meaning those two over there, or entry, or welcome. Just pick one.
Why didn't they just call it No Rat Island?
Well, see, there you go. let's call them.
We'll send them a letter.
Yeah, now, Rat Island is the Alaskan Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, and it is at the far end of the Aleutian Island chain that stretches into the Bering Sea.
Oh.
Now, it became infested with Norway rats after the rodents jumped ship in the late 1700s. Creatures multiplied, and in 1937, the island became officially known as Rat Island.
I suspect there weren't many campers at Red Island.
No, but I imagine probably a lot of urns and ospreys there.
Yeah, probably.
Now, a project several years ago to eradicate the rats and restore birds to the 6,600-acre island was a success.
Good for them.
No more rats on Rat Island. Now, also Anchorage, Alaska, biologists are warning about the dangers of moose calving season after several people were injured this last week by protective cows, the mothers. Now, the cows are so defensive of their babies that they will literally stand at the edge of the woods watching you. And if you take one step into their personal bubble, they'll come out, hooves flying. And that's not something you want to see.
No, that's considered one of the most intimidating mammals in North America.
Yeah,
dangerous.
If you've never stood next to a moose, you have no idea
how big they are.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's head out to God's country, shall we?
Oh, Colorado?
I guess you're right, Colorado. Frisco, Colorado. Wildlife officials say four orphaned brown bear cubs that were placed in man-made dens in February have awoken from their slumber and are roaming the Colorado mountains. Mm-hmm. Now, the bears were captured last summer after coming into close contact with humans.
So everything's okay now?
Everything's fine.
Good.
They're out on their own. They just woke up.
Yeah.
Seems a little late for them to be getting up, but without their mother, they had no one to arouse them and tell them
sure.
It's time to get out there and get on with your business.
That's right.
All right, you know what I always say, nothing smells like a wet buffalo.
That's true.
Well, let's check this out. Western lawmakers want to elevate the Plains bison to a status similar to that of the iconic bald eagle with legislation to declare the burly beast America's national mammal.
Should be.
Now, bison advocates launched a Vote Bison public relations campaign this last Friday to coincide with the bill. Now, the National Bison Legacy Act introduced into the Senate is backed by lawmakers from Wyoming, Colorado, Nebraska, Kansas, New Mexico, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Rhode Island.
Wow.
Now, the largely symbolic measure would provide no added protection for the estimated 20,000 wild buffalo in North America.
Hmm.
And the bald eagle will still hold its somewhat loftier role as the national emblem.
You remember what the original idea was for our national emblem, courtesy of Ben Franklin, don't you, Dr. Day?
Oh, yeah, he had a couple of ideas. One was the turkey.
That was it.
And one was a raccoon.
Well, you win a shiny new dime tonight.
Woo!
Good
All
job.
All right, here's some sad news. Hate to bring it to you, but... U.S. territory Puerto Rico. Researchers were unable to rescue a sperm whale about the size of a city bus that was stranded off the island's north shore.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a necropsy is planned to determine what caused the death of the adult female, estimated to be between 20 and 40 years old. They did everything they could, but the whale died about 5 hours after they discovered it this last Saturday.
That would be a hard thing to move back into the ocean. I mean, gosh.
Yeah.
Would they use a crane?
Well, no, they didn't use anything.
Right, I got you.
You know, we've talked about this before. One time, I remember one event where they had a dead whale, a sperm whale, same thing, big as a bus, and they used dynamite to distribute the whale.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Ended up destroying several vehicles, and people were injured, and... Yeah, so they decided that's probably not a good idea to do that again.
That didn't work very well.
All right, if you're in Cope Henlopen, Delaware, watch where you step. Several piping plover chicks have been spotted on the point at Cape Henlopen State Park. Now, the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control reported two pairs of piping plovers hatched chicks last week.
What was that again? What were they?
Piping plovers.
Oh, okay.
They're shorebirds, and about the size of the local morning dove.
I see.
Now, yeah, there's two other pairs that are still sitting on their incubating their eggs, and hopefully within the next week we'll have all the babies gone, and so you can go out and enjoy the beach again.
Keep us updated on that. You're sapping yourself.
We shall.
Okay.
All right. Now, they're seeing red in Asheville, North Carolina. Four rare red wolf pups have been born at the Western North Carolina Nature Center, increasing the number at the center to seven. Now, as you know, there are fewer than 400 red wolves left in the wild.
Yep.
And the pups were born to Mother Mayo and Father Phoenix.
Well, good for them. I hope they're, you know, that's a tough program because wolves do not have a good reputation with the general public, so.
Yeah.
You know.
And as we know, they are quite beautiful.
Oh, yes, they are.
As
absolutely
beautiful as the two wolves that reside at your residence.
That's right.
But probably not as big, because you have two of the biggest wolves I've ever seen.
well, they're big.
All right, now what rock and roll star is known for his tongue?
Would that be Gene Simmons of the band Kiss?
I think you're right. I think that is Gene Simmons. Well, Kiss's frontman Gene Simmons has some competition. Ecuador's long tongue bat boasts a 3.5-inch tongue.
Oh.
Yeah, now that doesn't sound very big, but the bat is only 2.5 inches long.
Oh, my God.
Yes, now the elusive bat shows off its tongue for the first time in footage next week in a premiere episode of National Geographic Channel documentary called Untamed Americas.
Oh.
Now, we would need tongues about 9 foot long to match the bat's proportions. Yeah. Now, to accomplish this feat, the bat keeps its tongue stuffed down its throat and doubled up in its esophagus. Now, it's a pretty extreme adaptation, evolving a longer tongue than its own body.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
The biologist Nathan Muchala of the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, one of the bat's discoverers in 2005. Now, it should be a pretty good documentary with some amazing footage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this bat is going to be first shown in the first episode of the Nature documentary, and the footage of the Andean bat is very impressive. And it also kind of tells a story of evolution.
I'll be on the lookout for that, along with our listeners.
Now, for the fact of the day, this one is for our studio producer, Melissa Hovey.
Oh.
Because we know she loves sharks.
Yeah.
Now, the bull shark is considered by experts to be the most dangerous type of shark, thanks to its aggressive nature and its ability to survive in salt, brackish, and fresh water. Now, here's something I didn't know. The bull sharks get their moniker from their short snouts, their aggression, and the fact that they often headbutt their prey before using their teeth.
Hmm.
So if you're swimming and something headbutts you, get out of the water.
Yeah.
All right, that's the Wild World News for June 7th.
Well, once again, a fantastic job done by Dr. Henry Day. We want to tell everyone to check out my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, and our Facebook page, Larry the Animal Guy and Friends, filled with photos and information about our animal family. Also, RadioMom.fm and the home of the Radio Mom Shop, where you can save 50, 60, 70% on vacations, restaurants, and a variety of other goods and services. And why not listen to my show, The 70s on Sunday, 12 to 7, each Sunday at RadioMom.fm. Those are a few of our underwriters that make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio. Our guest tonight, all the way from the fine state of Idaho, author of the book Sasquatch, Legend Meets Science, probably the foremost personality you see on any documentary done now on Bigfoot or Sasquatch. We're quite honored to have on our program tonight Dr. Jeff Meldrum. Good evening, Doc.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Did you recognize that piece of music?
Yeah, that was the Legend of Boggy Creek, wasn't it?
Yes, it certainly was. Was that one of the things that may have perked your interest as a youngster to follow this?
Oh, I think I wasn't alone in that. In fact, I snuck a cassette recorder into the drive-in theater to record the whole soundtrack to that movie, and I would fall asleep at night listening to that as a youngster.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, my wife said she had nightmares for weeks after she saw it at the drive-in. It was like. So, how is everything in Idaho?
It's good. It's really good. Lots of interesting things happening, and never a dull moment.
I'll bet. So, for our listeners that may not be familiar with that name, of course, any of the Discovery documentaries on Bigfoot or Sasquatch, they're not official, not unless Dr. Meldrum is a part of them. which I've become quite accustomed. Between yourself and John Green, it just doesn't seem to be a documentary about Bigfoot. It's not complete without it, huh?
Well, we try to make a reasonable, valuable contribution.
So are you still catching a lot of heat from your fellow professors and so forth about your interest in a subject?
Oh, to a degree. I mean, it's waning a bit. There are a few outspoken critics that like to stir the pot every now and again, just because I'm an easy target in that respect, I guess. But what's encouraging? I mean, on the broader stage of it, I'm encouraged by a growing. I think interest, especially in the younger generation, as they are exposed repeatedly to the ongoing discovery of new hominid species, let alone new extant primate species, together with the continuing revelation of ever younger and younger sites, younger finds of hominid persistence in the fossil record. You know, so last year we had a Neanderthal site, at least that the preliminary date was offered to us, as about 10,000 years old.
Wow.
Which is about a third as old as any other fossil remains. There have been a couple of occupation sites about 24,000 years. And the pace of these discoveries, you know, on the heels of Homo floresiensis, the hobbit, it's showing that in the very recent past, that we've demonstrated now that at least in the very recent past, or I should say up to the recent past, there has been and always has been multiple species of hominid living contemporaneously on the landscape. And so to suggest that for some reason we are the only ones now is becoming the more questioned position, you might say. People are beginning to ask questions. Well, could there be relic Neanderthals that are at the root of the Almasti stories? Could there be relic Australopithecines that are the cause of sightings of the Oreng Pendek and the Ibu Gogo and so forth? And, you know, could there be Gigantopithecus or maybe a Paranthropus existing in North America at the root of the sightings of Sasquatch? And so it's taken on a different tone and a different footing within the scientific community.
Well, I have found, and I was completely ignorant of this until I gave my talk for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, that they're quite attuned to this. And there's quite a few members of park rangers and biologists and scientists all across the country that now have a story to tell.
Right. Very much so. In fact, one of the things that we have tried to do in the regions of our field operations, and I work with a wildlife biologist by the name of John Mindzinski primarily in the field of in western Wyoming. And we've gone to some efforts there and here in eastern Idaho to make contact with the federal and state agency personnel and introduce ourselves and explain our objectives. And because given the nature of this species, if indeed it exists, it's going to be very rare and very elusive, and it's going to be difficult to study by, you know, the typical means that we usually observe and learn of the natural history of wildlife. And so the more eyes, the more lines of communication that you have, as you say, attuned to this, the better. And so we wrote letters of introduction and then went around and visited the offices and provided some literature, copy of my book and some reprints and our contact information and DVDs and so on. And we were met very, at the very least, cordially, occasionally with some polite skepticism, but often with a remarkable degree of enthusiasm and interest in what we were doing. And it has resulted in some reports that have come through those agency offices of footprint finds. One of the most stunning examples of footprints, 16-inch tracks that were tracked for over a mile and a half, very, very clear in the southern Wind River Range in Wyoming. So you're absolutely right. And that's, you know, I could repeat stories to you, examples of interactions with other Park Service personnel and forestry and biologists and who have had firsthand experiences. You know, they usually keep them to themselves for the most part, but you're absolutely right.
Well, I think on our program we had the legendary Yellowstone Park Ranger, Bob Jackson, who for 32 years patrolled the Thoroughfare District in Yellowstone, which is the most remote area in the lower 48 states. And he stated on our program, in fact, our listeners can go back through the archives. I don't have the date right on the tip of my tongue, but he reported watching one stalk a deer. And just thought for a good time. In fact, he said a lot of the trail crews in Yellowstone were quite aware of these things. They would hear these. I think his statement was he was on horseback next to a guide, on the hunting guides, and they heard this scream come out of the valleys of Yellowstone that he said basically sounded like 1,000 elk going to their death. And they looked at each other and they go, "What in the world is that?" And so since then, you know, and he said, I got so I would ask people, you know, have you ever heard anything? And he found that most of the people that, at least the trail crews that worked in the backcountry, they had either found footprints or heard things or seen things that they could not really explain.
Right.
So it's become quite phenomenal. And I think, you know, we kind of make jokes of television programs like Finding Bigfoot and some of the other things that have been on. But really, as far as public awareness, I would have to say that this subject has exploded within the last couple of years.
It has. Oh, it really has. You could just see it. And the level of interest by the cable networks is simply a barometer of that interest. They are very aware, in the people in the media are very aware of what people are interested in, and it's not just for entertainment value. I mean, that's the feedback I continually get from viewers of some of the programs that I've been or appeared in, and obviously have little control over their format and formula. Is, you know, give us more substantial, get to the bottom of the story. How come you didn't do this? How come you didn't do that? And I say, well, you know, they're on a limited budget. They have to have this in the can after a few days. They're not in the business of financing long-term field studies, which is what this really requires. And we have to turn, obviously, to other sources of funding for that. Although the documentaries have, I must say, have provided me in any way with lots and lots of opportunities to visit places and interact with many, many people that I wouldn't otherwise have had the chance. And I'm, you know, very grateful for that benefit.
Is there a particular part of the country or place that you've been that you thought was, gosh, this is phenomenal as far as gathering information about this?
Well, it's, I mean, it's tough to pinpoint something like that, because each area oftentimes has different qualities and different, at least to my understanding and my level of knowledge, a different historical legacies, I guess you'd say. So obviously what I think were the original core areas are those temperate rainforests of the Pacific Northwest, those very rich areas through the Cascades and the coastal ranges and up the Olympic Peninsula and the western British Columbia coast. I mean, we see the very dramatic place that this creature or these beings or whatever. I'm always hesitant to label them one way or the other, because everybody has their own perspective on what they might be or might not be, and of course we don't really understand that yet. But whatever these things are, this species is, it clearly is very prominent in the landscape there in the Pacific Northwest, and we see it in the very overt ceremonial masks and the totems and so many other aspects of the artifacts. Here in the Intermountain West, where some of the habitat is much, or the appropriate habitat is patchier, the things that come closer to those temperate rainforests, we see that there seems to be a more transient population and probably a more dispersed and even rarer distribution. And the depictions are much more cryptic, in the form of petroglyphs or in the form of geometric symbols within basket weaving and or even just down to within family crests, certain combination of colors. I've been told by members of the local tribes that's how this creature is depicted and plays a role in various family clans and crests. So it's, but then again, on the flip side of that, from the perspective of trying to do field work, the times I've spent in those lush forests, those almost jungle-like forests of the Pacific Northwest, it's very difficult to traverse. It's difficult to have any line of sight for any distance. And, of course, the ground is very rich with organic material and litter and vegetation, which makes tracking very problematic. And so in contrast to that, some of the areas like the Blue Mountains in southeastern Washington, a place that I've been a number of times, one of the real appeals of that is it's very patchy. There are areas that catch lots and lots of rainfall and are very lush, but there's also a lot of marginal land that has more open southern-facing slopes and a very high lust content in the soil, which makes tracking just amazing. And many of the back roads in that region are undeveloped, unimproved, and they're just dirt roads that make wonderful tracking beds and hence provide or produce a remarkable record of Sasquatch tracks. I mean, some of the most stunning footprints that I have examples of have come there from there. My own experience began there with a long line of tracks there in the foothills of the Blues in that really silty soil. So people are always asking me, well, where's the best place to go? Where can I go? And
sure.
I usually advise them that if you're in any type of habitat that also supports black bear population, then that's probably has sufficient rainfall and productivity to support another large omnivore. And so just spend a lot of time in your own neck of the woods. One of the most limiting factors for me is travel time to go to these places. And so that's one of the reasons we've cultivated a network with agency personnel and with local people and law enforcement here in the Idaho-Wyoming region, just so that we can keep our fingers on the pulse and get to know the people in the region and get to know the region. That's the critical thing. get to know the resources, get to know the movements. Where's the cover? Where's the forage? Where are the other food resources and prey animals? And then look for that moving needle in a haystack.
literally. Our guest tonight, Dr. Jeff Meldrum from Idaho. We're talking Bigfoot night, everybody. We're going to take a short break. You are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
This week's episode, Bobcat in the Cave.
Gosh, Johnny, playing in the cave sure is neat.
Oh, boy, a kitty cat.
Sassy, the kitty cat's yelling.
What, Sassy? It's not a kitty? It's a bobcat? Speaking of cats, do you like to stress the importance of adopting cats from animal shelters? Over 5 million cats go into animal shelters every year? And with millions of healthy cats to choose from, it's a shame more people don't adopt from shelters.
It's Bobcat, Abby. Help, Sassy!
Why bother? We'll just get into more trouble tomorrow?
What's that supposed to mean? Oh, nuts.
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
This is Larry Batson. You are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. We will be back with Dr. Jeff Meldrum in just a few moments. We're talking Bigfoot tonight. I want to remind everyone that you can go to our website for Blog Talk Radio and listen to all the shows we have from the past. We're approaching, gosh, within another couple of months, 3 years of broadcast with lots of fantastic shows as well as tonight. They're absolutely free to download. We encourage everyone to do so. Next week on the show from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Steve Chase returns. And he's turned out to be quite the musicologist. He's writing a column now in Virginia on music. He's going to introduce us to some new music and also tell everyone around the world how to download music absolutely free, legally. That's going to be next week on our program. We also want to thank McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado, on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park. We call it God's Country. Go to their website, info@McGregorMountainLodge.com. Also, Tire Service Plus and owner Jerry Jones taking care of America's auto maintenance needs. They keep our animal truck on the road, traveling thousands of miles with our wild animal ambassadors. Give them a call at 317-243-0700. Also, the iKids Fishing Show. It's the first show in the USA starring kids, teaching kids how to fish. 40 million fishermen spending $45 billion a year. The iKids Fishing Show is a keeper. More info at We Want You Cottages at Chautauqua Lake in western New York. Their website is www.wewanchu.com. It's one of America's finest fishing resorts. And also, we want to remind everyone, Melissa, Wayne, and myself were part of the first annual Chautauqua Lake Bigfoot Expo in New York. And the entire expo is available for download for only $3.99. It's over 6 hours of presentations, And you can go to TaquaLakeBigfoot.com and get information on downloading that. We'd also would like to thank all of our underwriters, such as Jeannie Harold and Harley Giants, who become individual underwriters. You can become one. Help support our show, our great program tonight with Dr. Jeff Meldrum, and also all the ones from the past. Go to my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com. Contact me. I'll tell you how easily it is to become an individual underwriter and become a part of our program. And those are a few of our underwriters that make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio. Our guest tonight, Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum from Idaho. I just prefer to call you. You don't mind if I just call you Doc, do you, Jeff?
That's fine.
So what would you say is, in 2012, over the last, gosh, many, many years, the most important evidence to prove the existence of the Bigfoot or Sasquatch?
Well, up to this point, I think, and particularly from my vantage point, it's mm-hmm. it's the composite footprint evidence. But I think we're right on the verge of taking it to the next step, which is going to be DNA. And there are a couple of projects now underway. One has been going on for some time under the direction of Dr. Melba Ketchum in mm-hmm. Texas. And now, more recently, Dr. Brian Sykes of Oxford University has announced interest in vetting some of the hair samples attributed to Sasquatch and attempting to extract DNA and sequence it from those samples. So I think it's pretty amazing. We've got two significant studies underway parallel to one another, and hopefully will provide independent corroboration of one another's findings. It'll be interesting, though, because there is no precedent for recognizing a new species on the basis of DNA sequencing alone.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'm sure it will tip the scale of public and scientific opinion in the affirmative, and perhaps direct more attention and resources to the study. But I think, that's when the work is just going to begin. And one of the projects that I'm involved with, that I'm excited about, is called the Falcon Project, where an airship is being designed by Mr. Barnes, and he is it's a 45-foot airship that will support a thermal imager and a high-resolution video camera. That can then go, it can go thousands of feet up in the air and conduct wildlife surveys. The advantage of this over a helicopter or fixed-wing airplane is that it is absolutely silent. It'll stop on a dime and hover. You can go up and down in the X or the Z axis and gain or lose altitude and zoom in on a subject. And in so doing, you can look down through between the trees. In other words, at the floor, you'll be able to actually visualize the floor, which a fixed-wing airplane can't do. Obviously, when it's flying over at some speed, and it has to constantly circle back around to verify any contacts. So, the point simply being, I think this will be an interesting way to try to get it at locating and tracking in some of these. Creatures in the field and begin to gather some ongoing meaningful observations.
This is something I've always thought. Live capture is probably going to be almost impossible.
Right, I think so.
Judging by what people have described.
And just the up-to-date, the lack of our ability, and then we've tried so many different methods and approaches, but our lack of ability to stumble on anything that would consistently attract these creatures to a particular point, I think that, if there would have to be something that they found just irresistible to bring them into a spot where a net or a cage or some other means, I think tranquilization is problematic at best.
Mm-hmm.
And nearly impossible given the size of the creature and given the habitat that it's in. I think this type of remote observation would be the most promising first step in trying to gather some meaningful field data beyond just that fleeting encounter.
Sure. And I've always thought, and I've explained this to people that I've talked to about this over the last 30-some years, this is not a big monkey.
Right.
That it's closer to, I've had people give us a comparison, Neanderthal and prehistoric man. It might be closer to that, and that their unpredictability has made it so tough to gather the information that needs to be put together to prove of their existence.
Right. Yeah, they're very gentle, you know, by all accounts, based on the composite reports, they seem to be very generalized in their behaviors and habits, and so they're able to, there isn't necessarily a limiting resource that one can focus in on and stake out, basically. And you're right, the nature, all we have to go on so far are the observations from those fleeting encounters by eyewitnesses, and who are sometimes rather traumatized by the experience and may not be as composed to provide careful observations, although we do have a number, I think, of very reliable descriptions of both anatomies and behavior, but still the nature of the creature remains a big question. So there are a lot of differing opinions as to how ape-like or how human-like. And recognizing that there's a fair amount of space between the known great apes and living humans, as we've seen from the revelations of the fossil record, there's a lot of diversity of adaptation that's potential between those two points. And so, I've always just been impressed by the fact that they seem to lack most of the accoutrements that we associate with the genus Homo, so the material culture, and the while they're very, very smart and intelligent, and particularly compared to the average wildlife that's out there in the North American forest, they still, for the most part, their behaviors and their anatomy can basically be accommodated within the variation we find in the other great apes, with some potential exceptions, clearly. Questions about language and questions about the ability to manipulate their environment.
Sure. Well, let's go through some of the evidence that has come across in the last few years and that has been scrutinized. For one would be the Patterson-Gimlin film.
Right.
Now, what was your first impressions? I know it's probably been a while when you viewed that piece of footage. What did you think?
Well, sure. When I was a youngster and Patterson came to Spokane, where I lived at the time, Spokane, Washington, and presented his documentary, it made quite an impression on me at the time.
I'll bet.
And, I was struck by the, even at that age, though, I was struck by the naturalness, the spontaneity of the movement, the lack of any apparent contrivance or over-dramatization, at least from my point of view, in my opinion. Now, coming at it as someone schooled and trained in comparative primate anatomy and having taught human anatomy with full body dissection for some 25 years now, or plus, I look at that with a very different eye. I'm still absolutely as impressed, even though I think I'm much more critical of what I'm looking at. In fact, one of the interesting developments is I was able to direct some foundation money from a very interested party to facilitate the completion of a very interesting study that was initiated by Bill Munns, who is famous for his reconstruction of Gigantopithecus and his many other anthropological reconstructions, as well as his work in Hollywood costume design. And I learned recently from some of his reports his expertise in photogrammetry. And so using all of those techniques, I have the good fortune to the privilege of collaborating with him on a what I think will be an end-all project. I think this will be the definitive analysis and finally lay this this debate to rest and just completely dismiss the often vacuous expressions of opinion that, well, it's just a man in a fursuit.
Right.
For example, one of the parts of his study is to, with using the photogrammetric modeling of the film site, confirmed by on-site survey, will establish once and for all the focal length of that lens that that was used at that particular instant. And with that information, combined with the size of the subject on the film itself and the known bracketed distances from which it was filmed, mm-hmm. we'll be able to simply solve that proportionality and absolutely, with 100% certainty, say, whatever this was, it was this tall. And mm-hmm. the preliminary finding suggests, as so many other things have pointed to, a height in excess of 7 feet, nearly 7.5 feet.
Mm-hmm.
So now you can't simply say, you won't be simply be able to say, oh, it's just a man in a fursuit. At the very least, you'll have to say and defend, oh, it's just a 7.5-foot man in a fursuit. That's a whole different argument.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I assume you've been to the site where that was filmed.
I have a couple times, yeah. And we're actually going to be returning again this summer together with a whole host of other researchers who have done made some very significant contributions to identifying that site and mapping it out and so forth. And so I think there'll be a lot of research brought to bear on that final survey.
That had to be, I don't know how to put this, rather chilling to be there, huh?
Well, it's changed. It's kind of hard to actually recapture. Even being there with Bob Gimlin, I mean, it was fascinating. I was kind of a fly on the wall the first time when he was there with the film crew, and I was sort of looking on and listening in. But it has changed so much that it's so overgrown with alder and choked with brush and vegetation compared to the appearance it had in 67 after it had been scoured out by the flooding that had occurred previously, that you almost don't quite feel like you're there. But it is kind of, when you reach down and you pick up a handful of that sand and realize, you know, that this is the sandbar that it walked across, and
yeah.
It does give you that that kind of fascinating sensation, you bet.
Okay, the Skookum cast, what impressions did you have of that?
Well, you know, the jury, I guess the jury's still out. I mean, there are arguments, and there are good arguments that are made on both sides of the issue. I mean, the principal counter argument is that this was an imprint that was left by an elk,
mm-hmm.
that it was an elk laid down, bedded down there, at least temporarily, and that the points, the different features of the impression can be accounted for by elk, and there is without a doubt some superficial resemblance that gives one pause. I mean, I felt some sense of corroboration, I guess would be a way to put it, when not only did Dara Swindler, who's an extremely accomplished primate anatomist, look at that cast and came to the same conclusions that I did, but also George Schaller took a look, and he was duly impressed with it as well, and intrigued,
mm-hmm.
if inconclusive. But the problems that come up when if you attribute it to an elk, then you have to account for the obvious discrepancies in the pattern of hair flow,
mm-hmm.
and the differences in appearance of what would have to be the wrist of the forelimb as it knelt down. And in which case the hair is growing in the absolutely opposite direction that you would expect if that's what the case that were the case. You have to explain how this elk literally levitated from a lying down position without placing hooves underneath it to get beneath its center of weight, and so there are things that where you come up short.
Right.
Now there are also some issues that with the model or the hypothesis that it was a large hairy hominoid, But the thing that really impressed me is after looking at it and in my mind picturing what had made those impressions, and then Rick Knoll went down to the Seattle Zoo to film some gorillas in various postures, and he happened to get there just as this one female gorilla had a bushel basket of apples dumped out in front of her. And she adopted the exact same reclining posture, leaning on one arm, down on her rump, and using her foot to push off as she reached, and she'd grab an apple. She would bite it, bite a chunk of the skin, and chew it for a second and spit it out, and set that apple down and pick up another one, as if she were marking these apples as hers. And the peelings were falling down in her lap and between her legs in the exact same pattern that we observed at the site.
Wow.
So there's two arguments on either side of the fence here, and the scale kind of tips one way when you look at this detail, but then also you look at another detail and it forces the scale to tip back the other way. So, you know, it would have been nice had there been a nice clear line of 16-inch footprints leading across that hard dirt.
Sure.
And ending right there at the imprint, but unfortunately the conditions were such that it just wasn't going to happen. So it's an intriguing type of thing, but to the average person who looks at it, it looks like a piece of modern art that you might see in a dentist's office. You know, it has no impact on somebody who has no familiarity with wildlife. And that was the other point. I took big rolled out print of this to our local zoo, where we have bison and we have antelope and we have deer and we have elk, and I showed it to the gamekeepers, and we walked out into the enclosures and looked at the bedding sites, and they unanimously said, well, yeah, it kind of looks, but he says it doesn't look just like the elk beds that we're familiar with. So
I think, as John Green puts it, the longer you look into this, the more questions that you have.
Well, oftentimes that's true. There are lots of tentative positions because of the inconclusive nature of so much of the evidence. But on the other hand, the more you look into it, though, the more that accumulated weight of data just piles up and piles up until you get to the point where, like with the footprints, and see, this is where you quickly come to the point, the informed position, that it would be more incredible to suggest that all of these footprints were, as one hypothesis put it, were tromped out by the Wallace clan with carved wooden feet, then it would be just to at least acknowledge the position or the possibility that there really is something out there. I mean, the footprints are to me, they're absolutely compelling that there is something, some unrecognized species out there.
Okay, recently, our friend of the show, our studio producer, Melissa Hovey, introduced to the world this unusual photograph that was taken supposedly by a cam tracker.
Right.
Now, what's your impressions of that?
Well, you know, at first glance, it's pretty stunning and interesting, and I've, you know, looked with interest at that various interpretations of the musculature and the hair. I was curious to see one person compare the hair to very similar costume hair. One of the things that makes me uneasy about it, when I on a superficial level, nevertheless, but is the fact that it appears that right smack in front of the subject there's a wall of vegetation, and it makes me wonder about what the person that positioned the camera was thinking. I mean, why they would direct the camera right towards that, what appears surrounding the creature, an unbroken wall of leaves, whether it's bushes or what. I'm not, I can't remember off the top of my head here, but
sure.
But the way it's highlighted, the object, the subject is highlighted quite evenly, and then you have that vegetation back behind. I would have thought that, you know, if you're placing a camera, you place it along a game trail or along some something with a little more substantial line of sight so that you
sure.
have a better chance of intersecting the path of an animal. But then again, I know I'm hesitant to draw any conclusions because I haven't looked into the details of the circumstances of the conditions of the placement of the camera. And in situations like that, especially with a game camera, I would also like to see, and I wish people would always be very forthcoming and do this, instead of just putting up a single isolated photo. I mean,
right.
These cameras click off multiple pictures, and I would really like to see before and after shots to provide some context for these. I mean, that can be very telling, like the Jacobs photo of the supposed Sasquatch bending over the salt lick or whatever mm-hmm. it was preoccupied with there. I mean, the bracketing shots show a couple of young bears. And when you keep that in mind,
mm-hmm.
There's lots of, we could talk a lot more about that particular photo, but I'm quite convinced that that is simply a bear based on the anatomy that's visible.
Well, my assumption when I look at the photograph, there's no mother bear that would let her two cubs be near anything that was...
Unless she was close by. Right?
Yeah. I mean, that's the one thing that bothered me about that photograph. It was like, those two bear cubs, that just doesn't make any sense at all because we all know how protective mom bears are.
Well, when you look at the figure that's bent over and you're looking at the tail end of it, and you can see the outline, and it's kind of a gaunt bear, but then you can see the outline of the pelvis, and the pelvis is of a carnivore,
mm-hmm.
and you can see the shoulder blade lined up. It's a slender shoulder blade that's lined up with the humerus in the form of a quadruped rather than in a primate-type shoulder girdle.
Mm-hmm.
The anatomy's not there.
Sure.
You can squint and look at it over your shoulder all you want, but it doesn't change the fact that the underlying anatomy betrays that it's a quadruped.
Well, this is kind of a strange question, but do you think in your lifetime this all will be answered and the evidence will be forthcoming that we are sharing this planet with a biped?
I do. I mean, I don't think that this dalliance with the DNA evidence can go on indefinitely.
I think
if we've got some people, some serious laboratories and researchers investigating this, we've got to come to some resolution here at some point. And like I said, I think that's the first step. John Green makes, I think, a really good case. John Bindernagel makes a very good case in his most recent book in reality, the Sasquatch has been discovered. It's just that science hasn't quite caught up to that situation and that circumstance yet. And, in this day and age, it will be interesting to see whether the conventions of zoological taxonomy and nomenclature will yield or will bend a little bit to these unusual circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
But short of requiring a type specimen, there is some debate in the literature now for rare and endangered species to be recognized on the basis of a voucher DNA specimen rather than requiring, some individual to be exterminated and placed in a museum drawer or a vat. And I think this will be an interesting test case of that attitude.
And I assume when that does happen that Dr. Jeff Meldrum will be in his office in Idaho with a sly grin on his face thinking, I told you so.
Well, I'm going to do my utmost to be magnanimous, but there are a few individuals that I'll make a special effort to serve up a hot steaming dish of crow, you bet.
Well, Doc, it's been an absolute pleasure. What a fascinating hour. It was great to have you on the program tonight. What a show, Dr. Day.
No kidding. I bet a lot of our listeners in remote areas are going to have a little rough time sleeping tonight. But I tell you what, I'm glad that Dr. Meldrum is on the case.
Absolutely. And we'll be keeping up with you with great interest, and we'll have an open invitation to have you, when this evidence is brought forth, to have you back on again. Of course, you'll be a busy man then when that happens.
Well, I'll certainly take that invitation to heart. You bet. Appreciate it very much.
Oh, it was fantastic. I want to remind everyone, next week on the program, Steve Chase from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, we're going to be talking music. You want to tune in if you're a musicologist. It's going to be a great hour. And our big thanks to Melissa Hovey and Wayne Larson, of course, Scott Carney for the wonderful Boggy Creek music. Have a great week, everybody. You have been listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Good night.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.